TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Behind the scenes of the Millennium Meeting. This is the first program in an 8-part series on the complicity of the leadership of the United Nations with globalization and corporations. On the eve of the UN Millennium Meeting, the International Forum on Globalization brought activists and thinkers such as Vandana Shiva, Maud Barlow, and David Corton to New York. They spoke to inspire all of us to pay just as much attention to the dealings of the United Nations as we learn to pay to the WTO. Here is Maud Barlow, chairperson of the Council of Canadians, longtime analyst and activist on issues connected with NAFTA, the WTO, the MAI, and the global move to privatize. She gives a fact-filled report on the counterintelligence movement that was created in response to Seattle and is now trying to criminalize the critics of globalization. Maud Barlow.
Well, I'm absolutely delighted to be here. It's a very important week for the whole world, what's happening here. It's hard to get as much of a handle on the UN, of course, as it is on our institutional enemies like the WTO and the World Bank, but this is enormously important. And this forum here is a place for us to talk about whether the UN has a place in our movement, and if so, what it is. Our panel is looking at post-Seattle, what has happened since Seattle. Seattle was, at a personal level, one of the most wonderful things that ever happened to me. First of all, it launched our international citizens movement against corporate-dominated globalization, and it announced to the world that the political landscape had changed and that a new form of politics had emerged, and that the world would never be the same again. Seattle heralded a new development and announced us as a force to be reckoned with, a challenge to the power of transnational corporations and the global institutions that serve them. Now, the force of our movement is being recognized, and that's what I want to talk about today, because I think we're in a backlash. First of all, good recognition is from a professor named Lawrence Solomon, who is with Johns Hopkins University, and he's studying civil society in 40 countries around the world. And he says our movement is the most important social and political development since the creation of the nation state in the 19th century. He says that we are growing in the 40 countries that he's studying at 4 times the rate of the economy. He says that we are now so big, and he talks about us as the not-for-profit sector. He says that we're now so big that if we were all put together in one country, we would represent the 8th largest economy in the world. He says we are the most important political development in the last century. Now, don't you think that the other side hasn't noticed? In fact, I would say that we are now in the midst of an organized, concerted effort to criminalize our movement, to criminalize the civil society movement that has grown up, and the creation of a global corporate security system to ensure that another Seattle never happens. We need look at the security of other events since Seattle. There was Washington, of course, many of us were there, and we saw the crackdown. The information now is going from Seattle to every other place where our protesters are gathering, and they shut the whole city down. In Windsor, Ontario, with the Organization of American States, which happened next, they had over 2,000 riot police in full gear. They had the delegates meet and live within a compound actually surrounded by a 3-meter high link fence. And they had armed police inside and outside the fence to be sure that nobody could get in or out. You could not get anywhere near the meeting place. The G7 meeting in Japan in July, the Japanese government spent almost $1 billion, most of it in security for that meeting. You think of that, to bring 7 men together, they spent almost $1 billion. And Quebec City next spring will be the meeting of the Free Trade of the Americas, Area of the Americas, which is the next step in NAFTA. 34 leaders of the hemisphere will be gathering to promote and expand NAFTA. And by the way, it's to include services and investments. So we have everything that got left out of NAFTA, including the extension of the dreaded Chapter 11, which allows corporations to directly sue governments of another country and actually force them to pay for the right to pass legislation. I call it the privatization of democracy. In fact, we now know that the FBI and other law enforcement agencies in the U.S. have shifted their focus from right-wing hate groups to anti-globalization protesters. The Pentagon's top secret Delta Force were employed in Seattle and have infiltrated student groups posing as protesters. They and other police institutes extensively monitor the internet and know our every move. In fact, the Pentagon has coined the term social net war to describe nonviolent conflicts between civil society groups and business and government elites. So concerned is the Pentagon about the increased power of civil society groups and their and our use of the internet, it commissioned a study by the RAND Institute to study our movement. One of the authors of this study describes net war as information-related conflict, which uses the internet, and I quote, to disrupt or damage what a target population knows or thinks it knows about itself and the world around it. In other words, we're entering into a kind of civil disobedience and a kind of terrorist warfare if we try to affect public opinion and take a different tack from what people hear from their governments about globalization and free trade and so on. Canada's spy agency, CSIS, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, just issued a fairly lengthy report equating criticism of the excesses of capitalism with, quote, militant anarchists, and links legitimate protest with terrorism. And they, of course, are calling for all sorts of security and coming up in Quebec City. Canada violated the rights of peaceful demonstrators at the World Petroleum Congress in Calgary last June when it arrested two San Francisco Bay Area activists at the Calgary airport when they arrived. To our shame, those of us who are Canadian here, our government put the activists, both people of color, in jail and transported them out of the country in chains and shackles. Our movement is also being studied by companies like Merrill Lynch and Burston Marsteller. The latter prepared a guide of the groups behind the Seattle protests and warned, what is less understood but perhaps most significant is the potential ability of the emerging coalitions of groups to seriously impact broader, longer-term corporate interests. Seattle was not an anomaly, and the consistent anti-corporate message of virtually all the groups is not just a temporary phenomenon. The study, they said to their corporate clients, was intended to help their clients, and I quote, to defend themselves against civil society attacks. These and others, like the International Chamber of Commerce, have clearly called for a strategy of delegitimizing our movement and of cutting off our sources of funding. They're directly going after some of the corporations that have foundations that have funded openly or inadvertently our movement. And the U.S. trade rep, former U.S. Trade Representative Clayton Yoder, has said that the next World Trade Organization should be held in a country, and I quote, where real security can be deployed. In other words, what you saw in Seattle and Washington was democratic security, and there are places you can go where they won't be so polite. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan actually recently bemoaned our power, and I quote, this was at a high-level meeting with government and banking economists around the world. He said, despite the extraordinary prosperity, the ability to move forward on various trade initiatives has clearly come to a remarkable stall. We all need to press very hard on the political process to maintain the role we once played to see this major advance in civilization come to fruition. In other words, what they're saying is all is well except we don't get it, but we have caused so much trouble the government's afraid to move ahead, and they are asking where they need to go instead of governments to move this process ahead. Well, they've even got Hollywood in on the act. You may want to or you may not want to, when I finish, go see the new movie out called The Art of War. Wesley Snipes. I'm not big on movie stars. Donald Sutherland, it plays the Secretary General of the United Nations and has been persuaded to use the covert operations of Wesley Snipes to broker a UN-China free trade agreement. All through the movie, the China trade agreement is referred to as the UN-China Free Trade Agreement. The WTO is never mentioned in the film, although if you go to their website, the agreement and the WTO are described in glowing terms. Also, they tell all the breakthroughs that Hollywood movies are going to make in China. But this really falls right from entertainment into propaganda. And the WTO on the film's website is called Critical to the Prosperity of the Global Economy. The only hope for China, according to this movie, is free trade, and the only vehicle capable of bringing it about is the United Nations. In fact, UN Secretary General Donald Sutherland says, you know, in the movie says, you know, if this treaty with China could just go through, the United Nations would possibly become a world power. Now, those opposing free trade and the art of war, those opposing free trade with China are left-wing pro-Tibet protesters, criminals, and right-wing racist extremists. The other development besides the criminalization of our movement that is taking place is the next round of talks from the WTO called the GATS, the General Agreement on Trade in Services. The GATS is in full negotiations or in pre-negotiations at the moment, chaired by Canadians. Canadians just, running the show from beginning to end. There are other politicians going around saying we would never sell out Canadian health care and education. Why, in fact, it's all being sold out under the GATS. Now, why do they want this? Well, let me tell you, the global health care expenditures stand at about $3.5 trillion a year. Global expenditures on education, largely still in the public realm, exceed $2 trillion a year. Water, they want to get their hands on the world's water. Well, we know that we're talking at early stages of water being worth about $1 trillion a year if these corporations can get their hands on it. And they have vowed, many of them, never to rest until the world's water is privatized. We are talking about a huge amount of money. If you can privatize those areas of life that were once considered part of the commons, that were once considered sacred, like health and education, social security, human rights, air and water, genes and seeds, even, as I said earlier, perhaps democracy itself, certainly human rights. Everything is to be put on the open market. The public service can no longer deliver it. Communities can no longer deliver it. It must be delivered by the private sector. So really, in conclusion, I guess I want to say that the questions before us here in New York this weekend is where the United Nations is going to stand in this scenario. So far, the United Nations seems to want to put a kinder, gentler face on corporate economic globalization. They've got, of course, the famous Global Compact, which you will hear critiqued here, as our colleagues here are going to tell you, wrong players, wrong model, wrong everything. They've entered into the whole water debate. The big conference on water that was held in The Hague was co-chaired by it's called the World Water Council, which is the United Nations and the World Bank, but it was blatantly run by the water and food corporations, by the way. They've gotten into the act. Water, food, and energy have all identified water as the next big area for corporate profit. And the UN was there like a dirty sock. They weren't as obvious as the World Bank, but they were there, and they facilitated the government meeting. If you ever wanted to see who was in power, here were the corporations and the World Bank. There was the United Nations off quietly with the governments of the world, agreeing that water is not a human right but a human need. Actually, our governments agreed to that, did not declare water a human right. And then they allowed an NGO forum, but they didn't give us anywhere to meet. We had to wander around in the rain trying to find somewhere. We caused trouble anyway, you'd be happy to know. Oh, and another thing the UN has done is that it has entered into a contract with the World Bank to bring e-commerce to the developing world. You see, what the UN appears to me to have done is to accept the basic tenets of economic corporate globalization, to say that globalization is good, but the problem with it is that its goodies haven't been delivered equally to enough people. And so we just do more of the same and find ways to expand the benefits of globalization and all will be well, this kind of a trickle-down of the world's consumer goods to the masses. And that's very much the language behind the State of the World Forum, which is happening as we speak here. What's wrong with this, and why I challenge the United Nations, and the challenge you're going to hear over this day and I expect for the rest of the week, is that this means that the United Nations is accepting the notion of unlimited growth and the marketization of everything, that the market can place a value on everything and that will protect it. These are simply unsustainable precepts for us to survive. I cannot say this more strongly. There's no language that I can find to express it. We have a limited time to save our planet and to save other species. We all watched the pictures of the ice cap melting. Those of us in Canada who live in Canada had a special heartache when we saw those pictures because the polar bears are dying. And we love our polar bears. We are collectively doing such damage that we know that by the year 2025, two-thirds of the world will be living without enough water. And one-third of the world will be living in absolute water deprivation. They will not be dying of starvation. They will be dying of thirst. We cannot sustain the process and the ideology and the system that we have put in place. It's not a case of right or wrong. It simply won't last. Some of us will live longer than others. Some of us will be able to buy more time, but it will catch up to us all in the end. So I end by saying, asking the question, where will the United Nations stand? Will it stand with the corporate forces and their handmaidens, the WTO, the World Bank, the IMF, or with our movement and our intention to bring the rule of law to this system and our intention to assert a whole new vision for the Earth? We are living through what I call a form of global class warfare. I like to compromise. It's my style. I'm afraid we've run out of time. The United Nations has to decide which side it's on. I sure know where I stand. I sure know where we stand in this room. And it's really good to know where we stand. It makes worth life living. Thank you very much.
That was Maud Barlow, chairperson of the Council of Canadians. She spoke in September of 2000 at a teach-in on the role of the United Nations in globalization. Later, I had a chance to ask her for an update on her work on water. Maud Barlow and I are sitting in the corner of the breakfast room of a small hotel in New York City in September of 2000. Maud, you gave this amazing speech on water at the Seattle teach-in, and you have continued that work both as a writer and an activist and a traveler. You went to The Hague.
Two trips that have been important in the water world. The first was this called the World Water Council. It's basically the United Nations and the World Bank and a bunch of big transnational water companies have come together to so-called solve the world's water problems, by which they mean totally privatize it, commodify it, put it on the open market for sale to the highest bidder. So they held this big water council, they call it, World Water Forum, and it was the second. The first was in Marrakesh in 97, the second was in last March in The Hague. And they had close to 5,000 people from all over the world, many, many developing country delegates. But it was run ostensibly by the World Bank and the United Nations, but absolutely clearly run by the transnational corporations. I mean, you never saw anything as blatant. It wasn't even a pretense that they were pretending to be there as a participant. They ran the thing.
How did they run the thing?
The World Bank and companies like Suez, Leonidas Dezo would actually run the workshops, run the panels, hold the press conferences, set the agenda. Then there was a government meeting, heads of the environment ministers from many, many countries, and then there was a so-called NGO process. There was no room for the NGOs to meet, and we had to find places to meet. And the governments, you could see, were just an adjunct to corporations. If you ever wanted to see a place where corporate rule really manifested itself without shame, this was it. The big companies and the World Bank very much wanted water to come out of there with water declared as a human need, not a human right, which sounds semantic, but it's not. Of course it's a human need, but it's also a human right, we assert. They did not want that kind of language in the document because the private sector can provide for a human need, but you can't sell or buy a human right. You can't profit from a human right. So, sadly, that's what the conference adopted, and then the government ministers who were there adopted the same language. So it was really outrageous. Now, what we did was we brought about 30 people from around the world, and we called ourselves the Blue Planet Project. These were environmentalists or mostly people who live in communities fighting about water, municipal water workers, that kind of thing, from South Africa, from Latin America, from Europe, from Asia, all over the world. And we made serious trouble. We infiltrated all of the workshops and panels. We would come to the mics and put our positions up. At one point, there was one panel where the World Bank guy was only recognizing corporations and governments. It wasn't even, he was just skipping by our people as they stood at the mic. So I got up and I said, for one of yours, we get one of mine, except, or one of ours, but I said, except for the first little while, we get two of ours for every one of yours because you have locked our people out for this entire thing, which is so discombobulated this man that he gave in and sort of let me take over cheering from the floor. So, plus we held a press conference every morning, every evening, basically just saying that the conference has been hijacked by corporations. We were all over the press. So it really, really landed. We landed, if you will. And what was really important for us was how much support we would get there from the delegates. And, of course, that was just so clear that if you were a corporate delegate, you were going to be very much on the other side. If you were a you know, a developing country delegate or a worker or whatever, they just were totally with us. So it was just wonderful. What was very amazing to see was how much the corporations and the World Banks and even the UN delegates talked down to the developing country delegates and would say things like, you know, you people are having too many children, it's your fault, when of course that's nonsense. 12% of the world uses 85% of the world's water and they don't live in the third world, right? But the subtext here is that you're having too many babies and it's your fault and we'll come in and help you. We'll help you by putting a price on water and then you'll understand the value. And I just loved it. One woman said from Africa said, you know, I transport water every day from a place many kilometers away on my head. Don't you tell me, you know, in the blazing heat, don't you tell me that you know the value of you with your designer water and your bottles that you leave half empty. You know, you don't tell me you know the value of a drop of water and I don't. Very, very different perspectives obviously coming together. So we came home from this, and I got an invitation to be a keynote presenter at the Stockholm Summit, which is an annual conference in Stockholm, Sweden, where the king and queen give a Stockholm prize, a water prize, every year. And the theme had shifted to all the whole issue of whether water is a human right. There was a day-long panel, which I was asked to chair. And suddenly our issues and our perspective, my topic was the commodification of water, the wrong prescription. And suddenly our topic was the central topic of this gathering of water people. So this is terribly important. This is a terribly important shift. And I tell you, take the time to tell you this because I think sometimes that we feel overwhelmed by what's happening and we think there's nothing we can do. And you realize that if you're in the right place at the right time, saying the right things, you can have an amazing effect. I mean, as far as these companies and the World Bank were concerned, it was full speed ahead. The debate was over. Water, the only future for water was privatization, commodification. And, you know, it was not ever going to be declared a human right. And all of a sudden, everybody's talking about, well, what is water? Well, who does water belong to? How? One of the questions I ask is, if we commodify it, who's going to buy it for nature? You know, what, a couple of environmental groups will try to buy up little patches of the earth or something? Who will bid on it for nature in an open bidding system? Nature won't be able to bid on it. So I'm feeling much more hopeful than I was maybe a year ago when I spoke in Seattle, because that was when we were first sounding the alarm that the discussion had almost come to an end. We have to have laws. But I keep quoting Martin Luther King, who said, legislation may not change the heart, but it will restrain the heartless. We have to find ways to change this system. And we have to do it. We have to assert this now. So I feel very much more hopeful that we're beginning to have a dialogue that's including the public. This has got to come to the public. I think what a lot of these people who live in what I call the water world don't realize, that most of the public does not yet know that we have this crisis, that if we continue to pollute, deplete, and divert the world's fresh water supplies by the year 2025, two-thirds of the world will be living in some form of water scarcity. Fully one-third of the world will be living with no water at all. It can't happen. We won't live. Species won't live. It's not as if we can fiddle around at the edges with this. And the notion that privatization is somehow going to take care of all that, while some people get very rich and can buy all the water they want, and the rest of the world does without, it's just profoundly immoral. Ecologically insane, and it won't even work economically. You know, I always love these people with their economic arguments. This one isn't going to work. So we need to get to the environmental community, we need to get to the public, we need to get to workers, we need to get to families, we need to get to low-income people, we need to get to people of color, we need to get to the most vulnerable in our communities and have their voices front and center in this debate. Because they'll tell you what water means to their lives and how they can't live without water, how none of us can live without water. And that it is, must not become upon a for-profit commercial good in a world of water scarcity.
So for people in Canada and the U.S. to keep an eye on keeping their water utilities in public, in the public domain as an important step.
And we can put controls on a public system more than we could ever put controls on a private system. So yes, we have in Canada community groups we call Water Watch. And we watch the water. We watch it for quality. We watch it for who owns it, who's interested in it, who's got access to it. We say, and I say, that water belongs to the earth and all species and is a basic human right, and no one has the right to profit from it at anyone else's expense. And we are just adamant that this has to become a principle. We'd like that adopted in the legislatures of every government in the world, and we'd like it adopted at the United Nations, a reformed United Nations, that stops dilly-dallying with corporations and stands for something. But we really feel that this should be implemented in law. And in fact, it is in the constitution of the South African government that water is a fundamental human right. Water usage is first for humans, second for nature, and only third for the economy. And they have their priorities. I would say maybe should be first for nature, second for people, but anyway. They have, they're, as far as I know, the only jurisdiction in the world to actually have written that into the Constitution. I think that we need that in every country in the world.
Maybe we need to combine humans and nature and stop this division.
Absolutely.
And say it is for us.
Species. We are, one of the things I said at the State of the World Forum yesterday was that we have to see ourselves as animals. We're just another species in the animal chain. And if we somehow think that we can live differently and allow all the other species to die and it doesn't matter, we're just putting off the inevitability of our own demise. So absolutely, we are animals in nature, and we must learn to live within our watershed capacities again, which means that you can't continue to have this model of unlimited growth. It's just, it can't sustain itself. Just on water terms alone, it's not sustainable.
That was an interview with Maud Barlow from Canada. Her pamphlet on water, Blue Gold, was published by the International Forum on Globalization. She is often called Canada's Ralph Nader. Among her books are The MAI and the Threat to American Freedom and Straight Through the Heart on the Privatization of Social Services in Canada. This interview took place in early September 2000 in New York. In next week's program, you will hear about corporate underwriting of United Nations programs, a new development promoted by Secretary General Kofi Annan. You will hear how known human rights violators such as Rio Tinto and Nike can get permission to display the UN logo. You can get the double programs on water and corporate underwriting for $12. The transcript of the full four-hour series is $12 as well. For a credit card order, call us toll-free at 1-877-TUC-TAPE and let us know if you want the transcript or the tape. That's 1-877-TUC-TAPE. Or send your $12 check to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. TUC Radio's website is www.tucradio.org. My name is Mariah Gilardin. Thank you for listening.